Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. Once again, we are journeying into the centre circle with another wonderful author to discuss their book. However, before we get to the important part, not that these guys aren't important, I would just like to introduce our two co-commentators on such an occasion. First of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you, sir?
Oh, we're very well, Stu, very well. How are we doing there?
Well, not to bore the listeners, but the dishwasher's just late, so it's just a nightmare. But other than that, yeah, life's okay. Life's not too bad. Looking forward to tonight?
Oh, yes, indeed. It's a fantastic topic, a fantastic player that's in question, and one that I grew up on being told the stories of. You know, my dad's kind of like, his young watching of football was through the 60s, and he used to rave about that wonderful generation that would go and watch and kind of like take in the opposition players as well. And you know, there were certain players that my dad absolutely adored, and this one in particular was up really up there with the ones that he used to love watching.
You're right, the book is fantastic. We've read it, and it's funny with, obviously, you know, we know that you and I are the same age, and this is a person that we know through a completely different medium, and yet it's just as iconic to you and I.
Yeah, completely. I mean, and to the point of having, you know, an iconic, you know, spit and image puppet, created in their likeness and sound alike. But yeah, we were of the generation that knew that side of this particular person before, you know, the intricacies of his playing days. You know, we obviously knew he was a player, but didn't appreciate that as youngsters. It's, you know, it's only through the stories that we were told, and then eventually, as you become older yourself, and you look at the football of the past, you know, you look up on YouTube or you read books about them, and just how good they actually were.
Yeah, it's you're right. It's a fascinating story, you know, told brilliantly. Gary, obviously for you it's going to be slightly different as a Chelsea fan. You're going to be, I imagine, fully engaged in this one.
Well, definitely, and as opposed to yourself and Stevie there, I'm honoured to remember Jimmy Greaves playing. And in fact, one of the earliest football memories I have is when Jimmy Greaves left Chelsea, you know, my club. So that, I think it was 61. I think David will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was 61, but around that sort of era anyway. So one of my first football memories. And I think it's also worth mentioning, you know, because we're all football fans here, that, you know, yesterday, I mean, obviously when this goes out, it'll be a different day, but as we are today, yesterday was a really sad day for football when Barry went out of business. And today, the news of Bolton Wanderers has been hopefully been rescued and survived to sort of continue their history. And you know, when we're all fans of a particular football club, overwhelmingly, you know, we all have an adherence to a particular football club. But you know, when one club goes out of business, it diminishes all of us as well. So you know, so massive condolences and sympathy to all Bury fans. But you know, joy and relief to fans of Bolton Wanderers today.
You're right, Gary. You know, it's a great point to mention. You know, I suppose, like you say, as lovers of football, you know, I suppose we all have a responsibility to take care of not just the Premier League, but the entire football league, the non-league. You know, it's you know, we're custodians, if you like, of the game, and everybody who loves the game has a part to play in that. And you're right. You know, it's important that we look after it and treasure it. So, on to tonight then, and on to our special guest. So, like I say, we were lucky enough to have been gifted a copy, if you like, of this book and read it, and it is incredible, an incredible, incredible story. Viewed by many as the most naturally gifted striker the English game has produced, Jimmy Greaves was a goal-scoring genius. A career that took in Chelsea, AC Milan, Tottenham, West Ham, and later on, Barnet. you know, Greaves enjoyed a wonderful England career, obviously tinged with the pain of missing out on playing in that 1966 World Cup final. It was a life at times blighted by alcoholism, but redemption was found. And, you know, like Stephen mentioned, went on to forge an enduring television career. Tonight we have the pleasure of talking to Mr. David Tossell about his book on Greaves, which is called Natural. David, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And also should mention as well, by the way, a five-time nominee for British Sports Book Awards as well, I believe.
Yeah, thank you very much for mentioning that. Yeah, I'm well practiced in the old Oscar face now. I'm looking delighted about the award that you've been nominated for.
I feel like you're the Jimmy White of authors at the moment, but that's all right. Hopefully that will all change. So like we say, David, obviously, you know, this is a book about Jimmy Greaves, but to begin with, you know, if you wouldn't mind an overview of the book and certainly for myself, more interestingly, why Jimmy Greaves?
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone who's sort of familiar with any of my books will see that most of my subjects are sort of rooted in the era I grew up in, sort of, you know, the 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, written about lots of personalities from that time. And Jimmy, I guess, is one of the sort of the big characters from that period that I didn't really feel had been sort of covered properly. He's written various versions of his own autobiography. I think it was six at the last count over different decades. But I didn't feel there'd ever been a definitive book written about Jimmy. And he has such a fascinating story to tell. I mean, you guys touched upon it already. When you look at what he achieved on the field, the elements of, I guess, you know, football culture that his career encapsulated, you know, the abolition of the maximum wage, England winning the World Cup, that kind of stuff, you know, tied in with his own great achievements and his own great disappointments on the field. And then to forge a completely different second career, one that he'd never really foreseen, and then become a sort of a national cultural icon, if you like. And you mentioned the spinning image puppet, which sort of, for people who remember the 80s, that really was the sign that you were an icon of British culture if you had a spinning image puppet. And then in between those two periods, to have gone through what was almost a decade of, you know, a real hellish struggle against alcoholism, and to come out of the other end of that, it just felt like there were so many sort of fascinating elements to the story that no one had ever really sort of told from a third person point of view. And that was, you know, why I wanted to write about it. From a personal point of view, I remember the sort of the tail end of his career. I remember his last couple of years at Tottenham and his sort of brief spell at West Ham. And even then, I remember sort of seeing goals like the one he scored against Newcastle in 1969, a match of the day, and at that young age, kind of having a sense that this was a kind of goal I'd not seen before, really. Someone sort of getting the ball from the halfway line and beating everybody and scoring. And then in the late 70s, I actually used to spend a lot of time watching Barnet. And, you know, Jimmy sort of rolled up there in 77 and had two fantastic years just at the time when, first of all, his alcoholism was at its worst, and then as he was sort of overcoming it and coming out in public about it, and it was sort of fascinating to watch him at that time and see, you know, other elements to his game, admittedly at a lower level, but to see that there was, you know, still a huge amount of skill in his game, even at that advanced stage. So that was really, the sort of various motivating factors, and, you know, hopefully the book has sort of done him justice.
We've got so much to get through, you know, and you cover, you know, his entire career in his book. But I think, I always seem to go first because I can. With regards to when you sort of, decide you made the decision, and you know, and Jimmy Greaves was going to be the, the subject of the book, in terms of people being willing to talk about him. Now, I assume, and I suppose, like I say, I know him, and you know, from the persona that comes from the through the television, you know, very warm, very outgoing person. And I would assume that people were very, very happy to talk about him with regards to information for the book. And was that the case?
It was. This is the first time I've ever written a book about anyone where not one single person that I tried to speak to came back and said, no, I don't want to talk about him, or you know, didn't respond to emails or whatever. I mean, I've written about people like Alan Ball, Malcolm Allison, Tommy Doherty, Derek Dugan, kind of people who can be fairly divisive. And, you know, it's, as an author, it's almost as informative when you get those responses, well, no, I don't want to say anything about him, or, you know, I didn't really get on with him, I don't want to be interviewed. That is, you know, quite informative in itself. What was interesting with Jimmy, that not one single person said, no, I don't want to talk about him. There's such a welter of goodwill out there towards him. And I don't think it is purely because of what people know he's gone through in the last sort of 3 or 4 years since he became very seriously ill and had a stroke. I think there was, you know, all through his life and his career, there was a genuine affection for him as a man, a huge admiration for him as a player, and, you know, massive respect for what he overcame in his personal life and, you know, got through and was able to create that second career.
I mean, obviously, you know, we're going to cover the, you know, the whole lot, but I think, you know, so, you know, coming to you, Stephen, I mean, you know, you mentioned at the beginning, with talking about your dad and stuff, and I mean, you can't over-exaggerate what a naturally gifted goal scorer, and I know it's all right, you know, trying to put players in different areas and things, but you imagine, you know, you think of Jimmy Greaves and he was purely goals. And you think what that would cost and the value, the market value of that in today's game, and even the market value of him, you know, when he was playing. But in terms of a footballer, he was a pure goal scorer.
Oh, instinctive. I mean, that's the great thing about players like Jimmy Greaves. I mean, I will always swear blind that the greatest finisher I've ever seen with my own eyes in person as a Liverpool fan was Robbie Fowler. That his natural instinct to find the net was just unerring. You know, he would enlarge the goal, so like the inside of the netting would, you know, almost become, it would become a target, so it would make the goal that much bigger. He wasn't just aiming at the goalpost, he was aiming at the, you know, the curve of the netting almost. And I remember having a conversation, I can't remember who it was with, but someone who watched Jimmy Greaves, and he said that Fowler was the closest that he'd ever seen to the style of finishing and the predatory instinct and just that natural ability to find the net. And it just gave you a little bit of an insight into just how good of a player that Greaves must have been, to say that Fowler, who I think was absolutely phenomenal at putting the ball in the back of the net, was just, you know, at least 10% of the type of player that Greaves was. So that gave you that amplification over just how good Greaves must have been.
I mean, Gary, you know, you mentioned at the beginning that, you know, you saw him play, you know, sort of, you know, towards, you know, what must have been close to his prime. And I mean, for you, you know, where does he rate as a goal scorer for you?
Well, as you say, I'm a little bit privileged here because, you know, it's one of the privileges of age. But, you know, I do remember him playing, you know, at his height. And I also remember, I'm not sure when it was, but he was playing for Tottenham, so it would be, I guess, might be mid-60s sort of thing. Tottenham came to Warsaw. I used to live in Warsaw in the West, in the Midlands. And it must have been an FA Cup game, I guess, third round, because Warsaw never got past the third bloody round. So it must have been third round, I guess. And Tottenham came to Warsaw, and Jimmy Greaves played for Tottenham. And Warsaw lost 1-0. Guess who scored? And I remember the goal. I was standing at the other end of the Hillary Street end, and he scored at the other end of the railway end. And he drifted in the box, and I think it was Bob Weston who was playing goal for Warsaw at the time. And he sort of dubbed past the defender into the penalty area and just raised his a little bit and faked the shot. Bob Weston dived. If it was Bob Weston, if it's not, I apologise. Bob Weston dived. And Jimmy Greaves just strolled past him and tapped the ball into the empty onion bag. Now, you know, there's a great talent in transferring the ball from foot to onion bag. And Jimmy Greaves is probably the player that I remember, certainly of English player, and you know, I used to talk about Robbie Fowler and you know, just, you know, Ian Rush and of modern times, people might say about Harry Kane, but no one had that poise and composure to make goals, scoring, transferring that, the ball from boot to onion bag, make it look as easy as Jimmy Greaves did. I'm privileged to remember him playing his pomp, and you know, you see on TV lots of goals. I saw him playing in real life, and it's one of those sort of things that you never forget. And here I am. I'm not sure how long ago, but it's probably 50 years ago. Probably a little bit longer than 50 years ago now, that, you know, I remember Jimmy Greaves scoring a wonderful, impudent goal for Tottenham against Walsall.
I mean, like I say, there are times, Gary, when I'm very jealous of your age. I'm always jealous of your lifestyle, but your age, and it's times like that when, like you say, I just wish that, you know, I'd seen more than I already have, but I suppose my time will come. But, you know, David... so, David, you know, to start off with, and Jimmy Greaves, he goes to Chelsea. He chooses Chelsea over Tottenham.
And why wouldn't he?
Gary, you've had your bit. So, I mean, his motivations, David, you know, why... I mean, obviously, you know, he goes to Tottenham later on, but why Chelsea? What, you know, what do you you know, why do you think he chose Chelsea for his first club?
I mean, I think that his own instinct originally was that he was interested in going to Tottenham because they were the club that he, the league club that he followed more closely than anyone else. So, you know, in terms of going to games, he used to watch a lot of local non-league football, but Tottenham was the club he kind of felt was his. But Chelsea were very active in the East End and sort of Essex area where Jimmy grew up. They had a scout called Jimmy Thompson who took a lot of players from that area, guys like Terry Venables and Les Allen. And he kind of got to Jimmy and persuaded him that Chelsea was the place to go. They were, you know, recently league champions. They had a lot of people that Jimmy already knew because they'd sort of grown up in the same area. And I think he persuaded him that that was the club where he was going to get the greatest opportunity, and that's kind of how it worked out. And he was, you know, he was only 17 when he made his first team debut, so he didn't have to wait too long. And he'd been phenomenal record in youth team football. I mean, the year before he made his first team debut for Chelsea, he scored well over 100 goals in sort of all the various different youth competitions that Chelsea's teams were playing in. So I think, you know, that was it in the end. I think it was the fact that there were so many players from that area going to Chelsea that he just kind of felt it was a more natural fit for him than Tottenham, the club that he, you know, had actually grown up with a greater affinity for.
We can't compare, Steve. We can't compare. But I mean, you know, listen to what David said there. You know, there is this element of, you know, I'm not saying holding players back, but, you know, we're looking at players. You know, the current trend at the moment, you know, some young English players are going abroad to get more first team football. You have players like Phil Foden, who is very much being held back. And, you know, and Guardiola will have his reasons. Manchester City will have his reasons. But you look at what David's just said, listen to what David's just said there, you know, and Jimmy Greaves, and, you know, and it's straight in. It's, you know, he was good enough, he was young, but, you know, the opportunity's there. And I know the game was different to the game it is now, but when you have such young, raw, natural talent, you do sort of wonder why players aren't introduced, you know, as they were then.
Yeah, and again, it's just one of those. You've got to hope that the coaches, the managers, know when that epiphany is, when that point in time where a player can make it. But yeah, we've seen it down the years that, you know, a 17-year-old will just drop out of the sky at some point and hit the floor running. You know, we're waiting for the next one. But, you know, you can go to Pelé, you can go to Greaves. You know, if they're just that phenomenal that you cannot hold them back. And I think that's what it is. It's that the talent is that raw, that powerful, that you can't contain it, and you've just you just have to let it go, and to whichever direction that's going to go, it's going to go. And Greaves was one of those. He ticks that box, and I think maybe the fact that they have kids so much younger now. You know, we're talking kind of like teams fighting over six-year-olds and so on for conversations I've been having this week about a certain player that's been, you know, goes to training at Everton, Liverpool, Manchester City and Manchester United. And it's mad that these kids are under the spells of clubs' academies at such a young age. But I think there was just a freshness about the era that Greaves came from and continued for the next 30 years, probably.
And I think the other interesting thing is that other teams, obviously, we're looking at, a club like Manchester United, where, but Matt Busby and the Busby Babes were clearly having success and about to have even greater success. And I think, Ted Drake, Chelsea's manager, kind of thought, okay, well, that's the way to go. That was the trend at the time, if you like, was to get kids in. So everybody was looking for their own Duncan Edwards or whatever. So, the time and the environment was right for Jimmy to be given that early chance.
I mean, Gary, you need to put your impartial head on now. I know that your comment made earlier, but I mean, obviously, as David said, he got his chance earlier at Chelsea, and that's that's great for his development. It was great for his progression. It was great for his drawing the attention and giving free rein to his talent. Was Chelsea the right club, the right decision at that time? And I know there's different reasons and arguments, and you'll never know for certain. But in your opinion as a Chelsea fan, was that where he was best served at that time?
I think the short answer is, I don't have an impartial head, but I think the answer is yes. And as David said, I mean, Chelsea won the league in 1955, the year before I was born, and then we took 50 odd years before we bloody win it again. And Ted Drake, after won the league, decided to go for the young players approach. And arguments will be posited that he put too many young players in too soon, and Chelsea sort of struggled for the next few years, and Tommy Docherty took over, and then the younger Chelsea players sort of matured through that. But yes, I think Jimmy Greaves was in a situation at Chelsea that gave him the opportunity to display his talents. And even when the Milan thing came to pass afterwards, and David makes really good passages in David's book about this issue with Milan, and he realised it was a mistake, and he wanted to go back to Chelsea. It's not that he wanted to go back to English football necessarily, although he did, but he wanted to go back to Chelsea, realised that leaving Chelsea was a mistake. I think the short answer is yes, he did. So he had massive success at Tottenham with regard to trophies. When he was playing for England, it was that was when he was with Tottenham, the successful times there. But, I'm confident that he would have displayed a lot of his talents at Chelsea, where if he'd gone to what were deemed to be a bigger club at the time, that may not have been the situation. And I think today it would be difficult for a young player to get into that situation and become a first team player as quickly, because the tenure of a manager in football now, especially the Premier League, the top division, is ridiculously short. And although lots of chairmen say we want the manager to bring young players through, they don't bloody mean it. What they mean is we want instant success at free. And I think there again, Chelsea are a good example at the moment, because this transfer ban they've had has meant that Frank Lampard has got the opportunity stroke. Obligation to bring the young players through, and players like Mason Mount, Callum Hudson-Odoi, sure will play pretty soon as well, but have the opportunity to play that they wouldn't have if they were having opportunity to spend £100 million on imports or other players coming in. So I think Jimmy Greaves was Chelsea was a natural fit. I mean, I don't know if agrees with that, but reading the book, it feels that way as well.
I think the way that Chelsea played at that time as well, they were one of those teams where they would go out and score four and hope that the opposition only scored three. And so I think that the kind of style they played allowed Jimmy's kind of goal scoring to flourish, even though in the end it was, I guess, you could say it was what undermined his happiness at Chelsea, that in the end he wanted them to be a little bit more pragmatic maybe and actually sort of try and win some trophies rather than just really winning a lot of games 5-4. Excuse me. It certainly enabled him in those early years to kind of really to flourish and prove what he could do.
It's, I mean, the bit that, you know, and Gary mentioned it briefly there, the part of the book that I found fascinating, and there's two reasons. One, I was aware that he'd gone to Italy and gone to AC Milan. I wasn't aware of how short a period of time he was actually there. But secondly, the amount of detail that you go into, you know, in the book, in terms of the felt like it was a book in it. When I was reading it, it felt like a book in itself. It was almost this epic saga that actually almost played out I'm not a slow reader, but it almost played out in real time, in terms of, you know, it seemed to go on forever. It was such a short period of time, but the amount of detail that you managed to put into those, you know, those weeks at Milan made it feel like I was living it alongside he was. And, you know, the misery that he seemed to feel was just almost pouring off the pages.
Yeah, I mean, it started badly because by the time he went to Italy, he'd already decided he didn't want to go there. I mean, I mentioned the fact that he was getting frustrated with the way things were going at Chelsea. And we were also in the period of, it was the final season in the end of the maximum wage, where no one could earn more than £20 a week. So when he went to Chelsea and said that, you know, I want to move, Chelsea didn't want to sell him to another English team. The Italian league were about to relax their restrictions on only having one overseas player. So, you know, AC Milan came in, offered him the kind of money that he could only dream about in England. So, you know, he signed the contract to go there. And then by the time the English season ended and, you know, he was ready to go to Milan, lo and behold, the PFA win their fight to get the maximum wage abolished. And suddenly Jim is realising that, well, actually, I could earn pretty much the same money I'm going to earn in Italy if I stayed in England. And, you know, suddenly he's thinking maybe this isn't the right thing. So he actually goes to Milan, said, look, I want to get out of the deal, and, you know, hired a lawyer to try and release him from his contract, but without any luck, wasn't able to, so was stuck with it. So he kind of went there, I guess you could say, in the wrong frame of mind. The other thing you have to remember, this was a time when no one had agents. I mean, Jimmy was 21 years old, you know, he'd got married young, he had one kid, he'd lost a kid tragically at a very early age. So, you know, mentally, he probably wasn't really thinking as clearly as he might have been. He was getting no external advice at all. Just suddenly saw this opportunity, took it without really thinking through the consequences, and, you know, ended up being a long way from home with people who didn't understand him. He didn't understand, both from a language point of view, a football culture point of view, a lifestyle culture point of view. And people who weren't particularly inclined to go out of their way to make life easier for him. And the best friend he had when he was out there was Jerry Hitchens, who'd gone from Aston Villa to Inter Milan about the same time. And they sort of had to have clandestine meetings at the railway station because their clubs didn't like players fraternising with the opposition. And that was really the only kind of friend he had out there. And that kind of got nipped in the bud as well. So he felt very isolated and very alone. And really, from day one, was trying to find a way to get home. And yet, despite that, he still managed to score 9 goals in 12 games, which in, you know, Italian football is a, you know, certainly then particularly was a remarkable record. So he was still managing to produce it on the field, even though, you know, he didn't get on with the manager and certainly didn't get on with the surroundings he found himself in.
It's funny, you know, the things you've just mentioned there. So, you know, obviously his age, you know, the lack of advice and guidance, and the relative lack of a regular pathway of, you know, of English players going abroad. You know, you mentioned there were players who had been abroad, who were abroad. But, you know, in terms of, you know, with you, Stephen, you know, in David's book, he did the business on the pitch, you know, as David's just said, in terms of scoring goals, which is what he was paid to do, and that's why they brought him there. But from reading the book, it seemed that the press, both sides of the press, from the Italian press and the English press, really hammered him for his perceived behaviour in wanting to go and supposedly engineering a move from Chelsea, which, you know, clearly didn't, and then to wanting to come back again. There seemed to be this almost like a witch hunt with regards to the media and what was written about him at that time.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was a concept that carried on for many years, that concept of kind of like upsetting the etiquette of Italian football and how you're meant to behave and conduct yourself. You know, the story of kind of like the door to the veranda of Greaves' room being boarded up because he'd been out there on the balcony drinking was absolutely mad. You know, but you can look at that through history and stories about Ian Rush in his year at Juventus, you know, all the way through to Paul Gascoigne and, you know, welcomed by the Lazio fans with the big banner that had a beer glass on it. And, you know, this was something that continued throughout the vast majority of British players regularly going to Italian football, is that you had to take it deadly serious and militaristic almost in how you were meant to prepare for a game, and so intense. You know, Dave mentions how, you know, that whole kind of scrutiny in the game just drove, you know, Greaves mad. The need for tittle-tattle and gossip every single day, you know, what players were doing, where they were going, you know, and that's from kind of like supporters wanting to know that, you know, the scrutiny of Rocco, of you know, sat there almost sinister, looking in a mirror, watching Greaves' door to see if it opens and things like that. It's absolutely nuts from kind of like our perspective now. But to live that must have been absolutely, you know, mad. It must be mad. I mean, for Greaves, and the fact that he didn't want to be there, he tried to get himself out of it before he even got there. You know, he tried to get Chelsea to you know, back out of the deal if they could. You know, but David intimates in the book that Chelsea didn't really want to. You know, which is always, you know, a very interesting scenario to it as well. That somewhere amongst the board members, that the money was more valuable than the player was to Chelsea at that time. But yeah, you know, the fact that he was agitating to come home from the off, that he couldn't see out the full season. You know, Dennis Law on the other side, you know, he was another that came back quickly, but he saw his season out in Turin before coming back. And, you know, Greaves must have been that desperate to come home that he was out there like a shot at the first chance given.
And I mean, you know, Gary, you know, David mentioned, you know, 9 goals in 12 games in a notoriously period of time, you know, in Italian football for very defensive football. I mean, it's a true measure of, you know, taking aside the politics, his change of heart, his personality, but purely from a football perspective, to be in a situation that made him so miserable and was so alien to him, to yet still have that 0.75, quick maths, 0.75 goal scoring ratio. It, you know, it is a true measure of actually just how good he was. And I don't think we can underestimate throughout this just what a fantastic player he was.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the two things. A, the title of David's book, Natural, does actually describe the talent that as, you know, I'd mentioned earlier that Jimmy Greaves had, from transferring boot to onion bag with the ball. And, you know, he was a natural goal scorer, and that had that ability to deliver goals. And when I was reading David's book, I'd got the half dozen or so that David mentions of Jimmy Greaves' autobiography, and I fetched one is out to read the passage, because I remember reading something before about, you know, and it echoes what David puts in the book. And it's a little quote of the book that I found. I thought it was very opposite, and he mentions Jimmy Greaves says, I did try to make a go of it, but it appeared to me that every time I made an effort to immerse myself in the Milan way of doing things, obstacles were put in my path. The daily schedule was regimental in the extreme. Like every player, I received a daily itinerary of the content of which detailed out every move from morning to night. Now, this is a guy who's moved from Chelsea, where, you know, laissez-faire was probably, you know, you know, putting it lightly, to this harsh regimentation of Nero Rocco in Milan. And it's a massive testament to Jimmy Greaves' ability that despite this fundamental, almost dichotomic change between these two extremes, that when on the grass, he could still deliver and did so, as you say, you know, 9 goals in 12 games. Crazy return in Italian football.
I'd throw into that one is that one of the most amazing things about Greaves' career is that that half season with Milan, it was the only time he ever won a league title. You know, it eluded him in English football. Milan went on to win the title that year in Serie A, and it was the only time he was a league championship winner's medal, you know, in absentia in the end. But, you know, he contributed to that with his goals in the first half of that campaign.
It's funny that, you know, you talk about silverware and, you know, and winning the league. And I suppose, you know, David, we come to, you know, when he does eventually leave Milan and he gets to Tottenham, which, you know, there's perceptions that, you know, you mentioned at the beginning that Tottenham was his, not as much his preferred choice, but his, you know, the club that he supported. There's, you know, you mentioned it briefly in the book where, you know, some people suggested that actually Milan was a way of bypassing and actually Chelsea essentially selling him to Tottenham without being seen to sell him to Tottenham. But Jimmy Greaves and Tottenham Hotspur, that's the, you know, the synonymous club that is, you know, certainly that I associate him with. And his success with, you know, at Tottenham, you know, not only in silverware, but just in goals, entertainment, you know, that those years there, for me, sum up what Jimmy Greaves was all about as a footballer.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, that also coincides, I guess, with the period, the time when, you know, there was more TV coming on football, so there's a lot more footage around of Jimmy as a Spurs player. So when, you know, people like us sit and talk about the old times, you know, that a lot of that footage is out there and available now. And you know, Tottenham, obviously, with the iconic team of the time, they were double champions when he joined them. And they saw him as the guy who could make them even better and, you know, to sort of finish off their campaign to win the European Cup in that first year, which sort of ended with them kind of going out in the semi-finals against Benfica. But I think it's a surprise to a lot of the players from that era that you know, with Jimmy in the team, they weren't able to go on and achieve even more and win more league championships. They won the FA Cup in Jimmy's first season there. They then became the first English team to win a European tournament when they won the Cup Winners' Cup the year after. But then they had to wait till 67 to win the FA Cup and were kind of in a rebuilding phase. So I think there's, you know, as much as Jimmy is connected with that period and you know, everyone relates him to Spurs now, I think, you know, Spurs players and fans of that time probably have some sort of regrets that Jimmy wasn't the catalyst for them to being able to dominate English football even more than they actually did. And when you look at the amount of goals he scored, you know, continually number one in the first division scoring charts every year, you know, it is a little bit of a surprise that Tottenham didn't actually get him even more winners' medals.
A question that we did a podcast a couple of nights ago. And we spoke to Ben Roberts about his book, and, you know, it's called Bottled, which, you know, looks at football's relationship with alcohol. And obviously, you know, Jimmy Greaves came up in that, you know, we mentioned that we were going to be chatting to you about this book and stuff. And obviously, you know, in your book, there's no real definitive, you know, point that's made in the book that this is where it started, this is where the problem with alcohol started, you know, it's here. But it certainly the, you know, within the book, there's a, you know, you, there's a lot of discussion about what was done away from the training ground, you know, the players, where they would go after training, you know, even, you know, you talk about Bill Nicholson and, you know, sort of reviewing games, planning training, planning tactics, all, you know, within a pub. And I suppose, you know, as we come through, you know, this story and we, you know, we get to his troubles with alcohol, but certainly, you know, at Tottenham it seemed, you know, that alcohol was very much an important part, if you like, of the lifestyle that he was leading at Tottenham.
Yeah, and I think that was probably true of most clubs at that time. I mean, you know, Chelsea, when he was there, was certainly, the guys there would certainly go out and have a drink. I think it was a little bit more prevalent at Tottenham. You know, guys like Dave McIver and you know, various stories of him being sort of carried off Tottenham High Street at the end of a Saturday after a game, and you know, Cliff Jones, people like that. It was just part of the culture, and it is when you have the other things that played into Jimmy's life, like we mentioned earlier, you know, losing a son as a baby, the upset that he had in Italy and the dissatisfaction with his life there. When we go sort of a bit further forward, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, the disappointments of missing out on the World Cup final, so many other elements that play into that. And it is very easy at some point for that kind of heavy social drinking culture that existed in football at that time to become a little bit more if individuals have that sort of either that personality or they have the other triggers that might push them a little bit further down the road, which Jimmy clearly did. So it is very difficult to pinpoint at what point the alcoholism kicked in, if you like. But there are so many different factors that almost made it a question of when rather than if, you know, it might happen to Jimmy.
And yeah, I mean, it's a great point. You know, as you read the book, and obviously we know the story and we know the outcome, but it is, you know, you are reading it thinking, oh, you know, the writing's on the wall, for want of a better word, that is, you know, how is going to end up. The situation that he's in, like you say, you know, if you have an addictive personality or a personality that finds it difficult to resist, you know, you're always going to struggle. But, you know, Stephen, you know, like Dude mentioned, you know, Cup Winners' Cup, FA Cup, you know, I mean, it's almost, I suppose it's another one of those what if moments, but, you know, but there was real potential at Tottenham. And, you know, as David mentioned, with Jimmy Greaves, you know, there was real potential for Tottenham to build on, you know, as David mentioned, that double winning season, to build a real dynasty at Spurs. But it never, it just never quite caught fire, if you like.
No, they were just, I don't know what you would want to call it, cursed or blessed by the era which he played in. You know, the 1960s were an incredibly open era for teams. You know, it wasn't a closed shop. We're talking the 10 league titles that were handed out. There were, you know, 8 different teams won it. You know, of the 10 FA Cups that were handed out, 8 different teams won it. You know, there was only one team that won the FA Cup on multiple occasions in the 1960s, and that was Tottenham Hotspur. You know, there were just so many iconic teams, managers and players, you know, the Liverpool of Shankly, the Manchester United of Busby, Harry Kattrick's Everton, you know, Burnley were dominant at the start of the decade, Wolves, you know, had their last success under Cullis at the start of the decade. Then you had Don Revie's Leeds came through, and there was a second rising of Everton towards the end of the decade. You know, there were so many good teams and so much competition. And yet it wasn't a decade that was ripe for the domination of one team and one team only. It was, you know, a division that was littered with great teams and great players, and it was almost a free for all, you know, for Ipswich to have won it early in the decade as well under Alf Ramsey, which got him the England job. You know, it was just such a difficult decade to dominate it. You know, you were either winning trophies or you were there or thereabouts. And you know, they came close on a few occasions. You know, that first season that Greaves got to Tottenham, that first half season, there was a European Cup semi-final. And they'd never play in the competition again until, you know, the 21st century, the dawn of the Champions League era. You know, that Cup Winners' Cup win was a huge thing for them, the first British team to win a European competition. And yeah, there was a sense of unfulfillment almost, but it was laced with silver here and there.
Gary, I'm going to come to you, and David mentioned that we'll get onto it, and we're going to get onto it now. But as Stephen's just said, you know, there was a lot of talented sides there. You know, we're talking the 60s. You know, and I suppose obviously the thing that certainly dominates for English football is obviously the World Cup win in 66, and obviously, you know, it's something that you've written about. And I suppose your perspective on the omission of Jimmy Greaves from, you know, not playing in the World Cup final. I mean, what's your take on the absence of Jimmy Greaves from that England World Cup side?
Well, I guess I was, I'd be 9 at the time when England won the World Cup, 66, so I probably wasn't sort of astute enough or developed enough of my sort of football, not the wrong word, experience to sort of offer a great judgment at the time. However, I think, you know, success is as success does, and, you know, Greaves scored a hat-trick in the in the World Cup final. So, you know, unless Jimmy would have scored four, then, you know, it was probably the right decision. However, you know, when the World Cup started, I don't think anybody would have thought that a choice between Jeff Hurst and Reeves, if England got to the World Cup final, would have fell in the way of the West Ham player. I think that's probably, you know, almost goes without saying. And I think Jeff Hurst would probably say something similar. In fact, I think David mentions in his book that, you know, that Jeff Hurst had a sort of similar sentiment at the start of the tournament, that he was happy to be there as a squad player, but Jimmy Greaves was the guy. He was the guy. You know, he was the guy who was going to score the goals for England. And I remember in the semi-final, and I remember this research, and as you mentioned, you know, the book I wrote about the England and the World Cup, that the injury that he suffered against France, the gash on the shin, some thought he could put him out for the tournament, but he thought, you know, I'll be back certainly in time for that. But when the decision was made by Alf Ramsey, and it may have been with a view to the opposition, I mean, who can say, you know, when Alf Ramsey's not the sort of guy to deliver a press conference and say, well, this is why I made my decision. That wasn't what Alf Ramsey did. But, you know, he made the decision, and England won the World Cup, and Jeff Hurst scored a hat-trick, although some may doubt, and I'm certainly one of them, that one of the goals was over the line or not, but, you know, they brought the trophy home.
I mean, there's two things here. There's two things, David. One is, you know, in your book you talk about, or certainly the feeling that I got, is that Jimmy Greaves never really fitted with Alf Ramsey's, whether it was his style, whether it was what he looked for in a player. They never seemed to click, if you like. The relationship seemed strained, certainly, you know, from reading what you put in the book. And secondly, the other thing is, you know, I mean, to miss out on a World Cup final, you know, has to be, as a footballer, not only missing out on a World Cup final, missing out on a World Cup final in your own country, you know, has to be the ultimate disappointment. And, you know, and you mentioned in your book that, you know, he's a bit more philosophical, you know, like you said, he's lost a child. And when, you know, when you actually put it into context, actually it was just missing a game of football. But, you know, the bit about Alf Ramsey, you know, whether you agree or not, I don't think Alf Ramsey really warm to Jimmy Greaves, and also I think missing out on the World Cup final, you know, it must have hurt. It, you know, it must have hurt him as a footballer.
Yeah, I think, you know, if we're talking about the Ramsey thing first, Jimmy Greaves was never an Alf Ramsey player. You know, Alf wanted all his players to work their socks off. That wasn't Jimmy's style, either on the field or during a game or in training. You know, in training, Jimmy would be the first one to look for a shortcut. He would just want to stand in the goal mouth and sort of bang a few balls in, or go in goal himself and mess around a bit. He wasn't, you know, a committed trainer in the way that Alf wanted his players to be. The other thing you have to remember is that and you're right, it was unthinkable for Jimmy not to be in the team in the final, given the kind of iconic status he had. He hadn't been in great form for a long while. He'd suffered a bout of hepatitis earlier in the season. He'd spent some time in hospital. When he came back into the Spurs team, he hadn't been in form. He'd you know, barely scored a goal in the second half of the season. So it wasn't like he was sort of, you know, pulling up trees. So I think that a lot of people, you know, certainly in hindsight, look back and think that Alf Ramsey was kind of close to making a change anyway. And Alf himself said over the years that had Jimmy not got injured in that final group game against France, he may well have put Jeff Hurst in for the quarterfinal against Argentina anyway. So I think when it came to the final, and some doubts still about Jimmy's fitness, although, you know, certainly looking back and looking at the reports at the time, I think that no one really seems to doubt that Jimmy was fit if he had been selected. I think, you know, the decision to put Hurst in kind of makes sense. You know, one of the goals against Portugal in the semi-final was so typical of what Hurst gave to that team. He chased what looked like a lost cause, got the ball back from the byline, and Bobby Charlton scored the second goal. The kind of effort that Jimmy would not have put in to, if you like, to have created that goal. And that really was made it an easy decision for Alf in the end. And then coming to the second point, yeah, of course it was hugely disappointing for him. I spoke to Martin Samuel, who got to know Jimmy well, very well, while writing his columns on The Sun in later years. And he said, you know, Jimmy almost had to accept publicly that, yeah, it was only a game of football. You know, if he'd come across as being too disappointed, it would come across as bitterness towards England having won the World Cup. And that was, you know, not a position he wanted to be in. So he was almost lumbered with having to kind of grin and bear it and not really fully admit how much it had hurt him. Whereas, of course, you know, it clearly did hurt him. But you're right. Again, it's how much it hurt him is open to conjecture. Jimmy certainly, I don't think, feels it was the only reason for him becoming an alcoholic, which some people have claimed over the years. But yeah, as a professional footballer, to be as iconic a player as he was, it would be like, you know, the World Cup final being in England next year and Harry Kane being dropped in the week of the game. I mean, it was just unthinkable.
If I can just jump in there, Stu, for a second.
Yeah, of course.
Just to give a little background for people who sort of listen, you may not sort of be aware. Alf Ramsey got the job of England manager after taking Ipswich to promotion, then winning the championship with what, you know, would be termed perhaps today as a no-name team. You know, he had players like Ray Crawford, who worked his socks off, as David said there. But very much it was sort of a workaday team. I won't say bereft of stars, but pretty well that was the case. And it was more about the team ethic. And so that was sort of the attitude that Sir Alf Ramsey took into the England job, and certainly that's what he applied in the 1966 World Cup. But it's an interesting point. Jimmy Greaves, I think, if I'm correct, had a goal disallowed against France for offside, and also he had a run from the halfway line where he beat two or three players, and I think the French goalkeeper was called Aurelia or something like that, took the ball into the post and it went away. If that goal would have gone in, I don't think there's any way that Alf Ramsey could have dropped Jimmy Greaves.
It's one of those great what-if moments, Gary. You've thrown up another what-if. It is, and like David said, you know, things, you know, the width of a post, we can argue about whether, you know, Jeff Hurst's second goal crossed the line, and you know, and it's one of the reasons why we love football. And I suppose, you know, on such fine margins, and you know, like David said, you know, some people like to point the finger at that's where the, you know, the alcohol problem started because he missed out on the final. And you know, I don't for a minute think that was the defining, you know, the definitive moment. You know, clearly it wasn't. But like we say, on such fine margins, you know, such things are decided, and careers are made, careers are maybe never quite realised, you know, because of such fine margins. And as successful as Jimmy Greaves was as a goal scorer, it, you know, his life seemed to be about the finest of margins. I don't know if you agree with this, David, but it seemed to be about the finest of margins, you know, things maybe overall just not quite going his way, despite that natural talent.
Yeah, and we've mentioned, you know, many of the things that did sort of conspire against him, and I think it's a testament, though, to what a great player he was and what a fantastic record he has, that even though he had all those disappointments, his career is still not one of those that we look back and instantly think of what if. And I think, you know, we still celebrate his achievements more than we think about the things that went against him and didn't quite go his way. And I think that is a testament to what a fantastic player he was and the kind of memories he's left people with. It's certainly not a story of sort of unfulfilled promise that, you know, that you would look at in terms of a lot of players.
No, yeah, I mean, you're right. It was, you know, any side would want Jimmy Greaves, you know, in their side. And I suppose, you know, coming to that, you know, Stephen, it's the move from Tottenham to West Ham, and you know, you could argue that maybe with a move to West Ham, you know, the chance of, you know, English league titles and, you know, European Cup success was never actually going to arrive at West Ham.
No, there seems to have been a degree of becoming stale with Tottenham, whether it was a case he'd been there too long. But Nicholson was clearly moving in a different direction. There's a large difference between the Tottenham of the early 1970s that has a successful run in itself, wins a couple of League Cups, wins the first UEFA Cup, gets to another final and a semi-final in between. That signing of Martin Peters, who, yes, he was in the 1966 World Cup final side, England side, but he was a player ahead of his time. You know, he was a player of a different era, almost. And there was a definitive shift in the way that Nicholson, you know, put his Tottenham side out and that they played, and Greaves become almost surplus to requirements there, and maybe the fact that he'd become too accustomed to his surroundings, he almost become bored as such. You know, winning the FA Cup again in 1967, you know, wasn't quite the springboard to further success, because that is a different side in the early 70s. And I think West Ham was a marriage of convenience, really.
You know, Gary, again, you know, you'll be far more familiar with the, you know, with the West Ham side that Jimmy Greaves joined, and obviously, you know, you can look at it from, you know, from who was the manager of West Ham at the time, and whether that was a good fit with what Jimmy Greaves' game was about. We can look at it from the reputation of Bobby Moore, you know, and his capacity to, you know, to drink, and whether or not, you know, really the West Ham move, you know, Stephen said it was a move of convenience, geographical convenience, and probably not a move to extend or develop his career.
Yeah, I think Steve's absolutely right. The latter end of Jimmy Greaves' career with Tottenham, he played with Alan Gilzean, and it was almost like a marriage made in heaven. Gilzean was, for people who sort of can't remember that sort of time back, Gilzean came down from Scotland, Dundee, I think, if memory serves me right, and he was the kind of guy who would win the ball in the air, flick on, Jimmy Greaves would put the ball in the back of the net, and they had a wonderful partnership. And so the move to West Ham, you know, I think, you know, no offence to any Hammers fans, but was probably a step down. And as Steve said, you know, it was a move from a trophy, potential trophy winning team, to a team that wasn't going to win trophies. And I think Dave mentions in his book that Jimmy Greaves mentions about, you know, the opportunity to play with Jeff Hurst and Bobby Moore, and that's fine, you know. And that, but I think
it sounds when it's put that way, it sounds like it's a move, you know, to almost to reconnect with the fun of playing like he had at Chelsea. Maybe that was something that was subconsciously in mind, because Chelsea was fun, but the reality, as David said, of not challenging for trophies became too much for Greaves at Chelsea in the end. You know, yeah. Just a quick one to go back to that World Cup and not playing in the final. The fact that he only played for England three times beyond that World Cup, and his last game for England, he was still only 27. You know, the age that at that era would be the peak of his powers. You know, there's huge voids for me that appear in Greaves' career as it progresses. The fact that his international career is over by 27, you know, he moves to West Ham at around about 29. You know, he should still have plenty of life in him, and plenty of, you know, optimism and ambition there. And the fact that he eventually walks away from the game at 31, you know, it's... I think errors that he sees in hindsight, he saw in hindsight, but I would explain that move to West Ham, he might have sold it to himself as reconnecting with the fun of the game. It's almost similar to Keegan years later signing for Southampton at the Dow.
I think strange enough, Stephen, we've worked together too long, mate. You took the words right out of my mouth, and you know, I mean, I think that's absolutely what I was going to say. You know, it was an emotional move rather than a career move. And, you know, I say the, desire to go and play with Moore first, but that's not necessarily a good career move, moving from Tottenham to West Ham.
Yeah. It's back to his stomping ground as well, isn't it? It's not far from where he grew up. Yeah. And, you know, it's all something that's familiar and comforting and consoling in some sort of way. So, you know, it'd be interesting to have known exactly what he was at least subconsciously looking for in that move.
I do wonder. Go,
I was going to say, he didn't get an awful lot of choice in it anyway. I mean, it was deadline day. He got a call from Bill Nicholson saying that, you know, Ron Greenwood wants to sign you, go and see him. And it was, you know, there's going to be a swap deal involving Martin Peters. You got an hour to make up your mind. And kind of faced with that, and faced with the rejection, you know, the apparent rejection from Tottenham, And you're right, the thought, well, at least I can stay close to home. I can play with my mates, you know, Bobby Moore and Jeff Hurst. In the, you know, on, at the time, it kind of seemed like the logical thing to do, to kind of go along with it. And you're right, it didn't take him too long to realise that he'd made the wrong move, you know, partly because in the end, you could say it ended up being too fun. It was too much like a social club. I mean, the drinking that had been there at Tottenham was even greater at West Ham. Harry Redknapp, you know, talks in the book about, you know, the first training session after which Jimmy took part in at West Ham. They all went to the Slater's Arms pub afterwards, and, you know, Jimmy was still there 5-6 hours later, and everybody realised that they weren't going to be able to keep up with him. And in the end, you know, the football just became something that was kind of keeping Jimmy away from his drinking. And that was why, you know, summer of 71, he decided that really it was there was no longer the joy in the game for him, and he wanted to get out of it.
Can you usurp your role for a second? That's the question. Football moves on, and tactics and approaches to the game change. You know, do you think that, you know, one of the reasons Bill Nicholson decided to move Jimmy Greaves on was that the era of the, and it sounds crazy to say this, and I'll recognise it when I say it, that the era of the guy who just scores goals was almost a thing of the past now, and the era of the hard-working forward, the centre-forward who worked hard and, you know, chased down the defenders and all these things was more prominent, and that almost that the sense that the game had left him behind a little bit.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it. I think, you know, the sort of pragmatism that Alf Ramsey brought to his approach to it, and, you know, we talked about the reasons why Jimmy was left out of the World Cup team. You know, in the end, even someone like Bill Nicholson, who I guess you could say was, you know, one of the great sort of romantics, you know, realised that was the way things were going. There's a lovely quote in the book from Steve Perryman, who got into the Spurs team in the year that Jimmy's final season there. And he said, you know, he got into the team as an inside forward who could play a bit of football. And, you know, he soon realised within the first couple of weeks that he was there as, you know, an umper and dumper. And he was just there to run around and not really play football. And his brother said, I'm not going to come and watch you play anymore. You used to be a really good player. Now all you're doing is just running around in circles. And yeah, that's not the you that I've come to know as a footballer. And I don't want to watch you play like that anymore. And you're right. That was definitely the sort of prevailing mood around the game at the time. So I think you're right. The sort of the more, you know, silky skills, if you like, of a Jimmy Greaves, someone who could... was not only great around the box, and I think this is one of the things that when people talk about him being the greatest goal scorer, you almost think only of his sort of instincts around the box. But Jimmy could get the ball on the halfway line, like Lionel Messi can now, and sort of beat three or four players and sort of tuck the ball into the corner. Those kind of things were becoming less important. You know, the defenders weren't taking any prisoners, tactics were changing, and there was less opportunity for players like Jimmy to flourish in that environment. And so, yeah, you're right. I think, you know, his time, if you like, could be said to be coming to an end. Although, let's not forget, in 68-69, the last full season at Spurs before he left, he had been the First Division's leading goal scorer again.
Yeah, I think the point is, and thank you for sort of, you know, thank you for agreeing with me. It's not that it's necessarily true, but I think it's a matter of perception, and that was the perception that it may have been true. Rather than in reality,
absolutely.
It's funny. Obviously, you know, we're sort of coming towards the end of, you know, Jimmy Greaves, you know, of his playing career, and I suppose touching on what you've just talked about there, David. There's the, you know, the Blackpool incident at, you know, at West Ham, and, you know, and that's, you know, sort of one of the things, you know, the catalyst for maybe deciding that he doesn't want to play the game. But do you think, because throughout the book, you know, Jimmy Greaves seems to come off as a very jovial character, very much about enjoyment, you know, everything he did, I suppose he did to excess, but, you know, and to enjoy himself. And I suppose once the enjoyment had gone from the game, or his perceived enjoyment had gone from the game, that the game wasn't being played, as you and Gary have just said, it wasn't being played the way he wanted to play it, that's why, you know, he retired early, because he just fell out of love with the game.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he probably thought that he was going to get out of the game to spend more time focusing on his business interests. He developed a sort of range of different businesses with his brother-in-law, and kind of thought he was going to be devoting more time to them. Once he did get out of the game, he discovered that what he was actually devoting more of his time to was drinking. You find with some people, some professional sportsmen, and it's obviously well documented that some people find that drinking fills the void that professional sport isn't able to provide anymore. With Jimmy, it was slightly different. It was almost like, okay, now I'm free of the football, I can actually devote myself to what I really want to do, which is going to the pub. And for a few years, that was what he wanted to do. That was what his life became. Even if his business interests diminished, he would kind of do a couple of hours of work in the morning and then spend the rest of the time going around the pubs in Essex. So I think, it sounds crazy to say, but in the end, he found something that he wanted to do more than playing football, which was drinking.
And I mean, I suppose, Stephen, that's, I'm not saying that's, that's the definition of an alcoholic, but when it becomes, like we say, we talked about this almost earlier in the week, when that, when something consumes you that much that it becomes your priority, and again, it's something that David writes about in the book. I don't mean graphically, but certainly in terms of the detail and the level of the alcoholism and the situation that Jimmy Greaves found himself in, as David said, it became clear that actually football no longer was the interest and that drinking was.
Yeah, I mean, we can go back to Ben's book the other day about how, the shackles are off, and there are no rules. There is no structure to a player's day or, the training, the match, the build-up to a match at the weekend. Even through a summer, the eventual need to get fit for the start of the following season, suddenly all the rules that were there are gone. But as I alluded to earlier, I think to me, on a detached point of view and looking from the outside in, those voids seem to have affected Greaves quite profoundly. That loss of an international career at 27, being moved on from Tottenham at 29, 30, and then eventually kind of like calling quits at 31, a very young age even then, to be saying, right, that's it from a football career. You didn't, continue for the love of the game like some players did and go down the divisions and playing for the smaller teams down in the second, third and fourth division. He just said enough's enough. And what else was there for him at that time that whole concept of the pub was part of his routine. If he didn't go to the pub and didn't play football, then what was he going to do? If you take away half of your routine, then he clearly clung to the second half, the opposite side of that coin.
Gary, Jimmy, as we've talked about right from the start, Jimmy Greaves is a fantastic footballer and the alcoholism is a part of his story. It's a part of, what David's written about, and David takes us right down to the lowest point where he's on his knees, amongst the bin bags looking for the last sort of dregs of alcohol that he can find. He goes, I suppose, as low as it's almost possible to get. And then there's this almost epiphany, if you like, although someone say that, that's it. This is the last drink, and it's sheer strength of character, strength of mind. I briefly go back to the time at Milan, and people would question his ability to stick with something. But then when the decision is made, he's reached a low point, and then that decision is made to not drink, and it's sheer strength of character, because what he doesn't do is remove himself from an environment where alcohol, is still around. He still immerses himself in the environment, which arguably makes it an even greater strength of character for how he went about literally changing his life.
Yeah, and I guess unless you've been in that situation where there's an addiction to either alcohol or drugs or whatever, you can't know how difficult it is to break that cycle. But you hear stories, you read books about people who've sort of been in that dark pit, and I suppose Milligan once had described depression as being at the bottom of a well and not knowing which way is up. And, Jimmy Greaves found the ladder and found the way up, and perhaps it was strength that gave him the ladder, perhaps it was character that perhaps it was belief, perhaps it was desire, I don't know, but to break an addiction to alcohol on a matter of conviction and to maintain it shows an astounding strength of character that is probably more laudable than all his footballing achievements.
Yeah, and you know that you know it's a great comment to make. You know, for all the goals, for all the statistics, for all the for the silverware that he did win, you know, like you say, without sounding too corny and too trite, but you know, his greatest victory was was the one against alcoholism. And I suppose David, the last real subject to talk on then is within this redemption comes this second career, if you like, that his personality seems almost perfect for, and and obviously that's his relationship with the media.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't anything he ever expected to happen, and it sort of happened really by accident out of one of the things that he did when he gave up the drink. And I would say, I think one of the great things about the way Jimmy Gray gave up alcoholism, and maybe one of the reasons why he doesn't necessarily get huge credit for it, is that he didn't ever let his sort of reformed alcoholism, if you like, to become what defined him. He dealt with it and he kind of moved on. And, even now, I think we think of Jimmy Greaves either as the sort of the great footballer or the great TV personality. We don't automatically think of him as the reformed alcoholic because he never wanted to be that. Once he'd given up the drink, he wrote an autobiography about it. He gave a couple of interviews to promote the book, and then he did a documentary about the sort of perils of alcoholism and his fight against it, and then kind of left it behind. But ironically, it was his performance in that documentary, where he kind of spoke directly to the camera a lot of the time, that actually, woke people up to the fact that maybe he could do a job on TV for us. And it was actually ATV, which was then the Midlands TV franchise, where Billy Wright, the old England captain, was head of sport and was working with people like Gary Newbon. They were looking for someone to kind of be the analyst on their sort of Midlands football shows. And even though Jimmy had no connection with the Midlands, it was suggested to them that he's writing the columns in the Sun now. It sounds like he knows what he's talking about. Here he is on camera. He looks pretty good. He knows what camera to look at and everything else. We should give him a go. And lo and behold, a second career that he'd never planned for, never expected to have, just kind of materializes. And again, he turns out to be a natural. After a first few failed attempts to try and follow a script or an auto cue, everybody agrees that the best thing to do is just to let him be himself, just let him sit there and joke and gag his way through it and throw in his opinions, and people will relate to him because he comes across as one of them. He's talking to them like they would talk to the guy down the pub. And suddenly this whole new world opens up to him.
I mean, Gary, you hail from the Midlands. I'm assuming that obviously this sort of early introduction to the media, did you watch it?
Absolutely, and I mean, there again, I've sort of got an inside track on Jimmy Greaves there, and I think if there's a case that we spoke about earlier where football left Jimmy Greaves behind a little bit, then this is the reverse case, because Jimmy Greaves on I think it was called Star Soccer at the time on ATV, it was ahead of the curve. Things came afterwards where football was looked at not po-faced. It was looked at with humour. It was looked at, as David mentioned a few seconds ago, it's like he's chatting to you down the pub. That's probably a little bit delicate because of Jimmy's history. But, it was easy. It was comfortable and it wasn't difficult. And there was a shared love of the game and an appreciation of a player's ability. But it wasn't it wasn't school mastery, which was certainly of the time, that was what football analysis had been. But he broke the mould. And as I say, he was ahead of the curve. And David mentions the book, TV programmes like Fantasy Football with Badil and Skinner. I'm not sure that would have even come to be if it hadn't been for Greaves breaking the mould, as he did with the football analysis he did for Midlands TV. And it was certainly, it was entertaining. But as I say, the phrase I would use is it was easy to listen to, it was easy to understand. It wasn't schoolmastery. It was nice and it was comfortable, and easy is the word.
It's funny. I mean, David's titled his book "Natural," and you mentioned it earlier, Gary. That it's probably the most natural goal scored. But it would almost be that even as he was a natural, in front of the camera and with the media as well. And certainly, obviously, we started at the beginning, Stephen. You know, for me, when you look at St. Greavesy, I think I was about 13. I think when it first started. We've talked about sort of rituals on match day, and every Saturday. St. Greavesy was what you waited for, was it? You waited for their programme, you waited for their almost comment on what was happening in football, and people valued the comment, even though it was done jovially and lightheartedly, as Gary just mentioned, but it had enough substance to it that it was taken seriously.
Oh, it did. I mean, that was it. I mean, we went back to kind of like the days of World of Sport when it was like on the ball and stuff like that. And I think he even stumbled into that vaguely by accident, because I think Ian St. John used to do the show on his own, but then kind of like introduced this little off camera bit to Jimmy Greaves, who was up in Birmingham at ATV, where they were doing like Tiswas, because he even got involved in like Tiswas for a bit. And then he'd do a little couple of minutes section in a little box in the corner of the screen while St. John's talking to the screen. And then the two of them hit it off that well that eventually he was absorbed into the programme as a double act. And so what we used to have kind of like football focus, kind of like earlier, half an hour earlier, which was where you got your serious kind of like football analysis. And that was the broadsheet part of it. And then he is St. Greavesy with kind of like where it's more fun and it's a little bit tongue in cheek. So you had the yin and the yang there of the two different programmes, and then you were off to go and watch a game of football. What was better on a Saturday lunchtime?
it did. You planned your Saturday around it. Whether your team were at home or if your team were away, it was still an integral part of your Saturday. Saturday routine. Fellas, we've gone over, and that's all right because I'm recording it so we can do that and I'm kind of in charge. But obviously, Jimmy Greaves is someone that we could talk about, I would imagine, for another hour, or we could have done two shows, one about his football career and one about his post-football career. But in terms of, just to finish with, I suppose when you have such a fascinating career and a career that goes, that we talk about a lot, that transcends football and goes, people will know of Jimmy Greaves be it through the media, be it through his fight with alcoholism, be it through, as a footballer. And I suppose, and this is not an easy question, I apologise, but like I say, I'm in charge, so it's all right. And I don't have to answer it. The legacy, or what you perceive Jimmy Greaves' legacy to be. So I'm going to ask all three of you, which... I appreciate it's going to be difficult, but as you're the special guest, David, you're allowed to go first, and it's your book, and you're the reason why we're here. So, for you as a person, where do you see, or what do you see as Jimmy Greaves' legacy being?
I think what he would like to think that his legacy is are the connections that he's made with people, the memories that people have of him scoring goals or being on TV, and the enjoyment that has brought to them, and the fact that they can pinpoint certain moments in their life around his achievements. Again, mentioning Martin Samuel, he said that, one of the last interviews he did with Jimmy Greaves, Jimmy would talk about how often people would come up to him and talk about goals that they'd seen him score, and Jimmy wouldn't remember them, but they said, yeah, I remember it because, it was Charlie had just bought himself a pie and a pint, and you scored the goal, and then everybody jumped up in the air. And he said the story wasn't really about Jimmy Greaves, it was about Charlie's pie and his pint, but Jimmy was the sort of the person that sort of positioned it in time, and he was fine with that, and he enjoyed that. So I think Jimmy would want his legacy to be the connections that he created with people and the memories he created for them, and the joy that he brought into their lives.
Wonderful. I'm really sorry, Gary, but you've now got to follow that. So for you, Gary, you know, what is his legacy?
Well, as I said earlier, I remember Jimmy Greaves playing at Walsall Fellows Park, and while we've been talking, I've looked it up. I mean, I won't say I can recall it, because I've looked it up. It was 4th of January. It was an FA Cup game, Walsall against Tottenham. And the goal that Jimmy Greaves scored, and I remember it, it wasn't because of this conversation. I remember it as being one of those ridiculous things, with ability, skill, composure. I guess the word I'm looking for is the natural talent that Jimmy Greaves had of, you know, as I've said, transferring the ball from foot to back of the onion bag. I remember dancing through the Walsall defence, dumbing the goalkeeper, rolling into the empty bat, empty net, and turning away and celebrating. So for me, you know, OK, Jimmy Greaves was entertaining as a pundit on football, on the TV, but I will always remember him as an elegant, efficient, ridiculously massive ability as a goal scorer.
Brilliant. OK, so Stephen, just yourself now. Oh. You're now left with the third choice.
Yeah. No pressure. No, I'd just add his kind of like effortlessness to everything he seemed to do, because it never, you know, obviously we're of that 80s generation where he was the man on the television. You know, the football came second to us. We were the opposite way around on yeah. Jimmy Greaves. And it was just that effortless joy, you know, everything seemed to be, you know, fun and natural. Again, there's that word, and yeah, he was just born to kind of like give joy.
I've got to say, David, I think if we had a competition for the most appropriate and yet simplistic title of a book, yours would win hands down. So I've now got another question: the title, where did it come from?
Really just from kind of thinking about what best would sum up Jimmy Greaves. I mean, I didn't want to call it the Jimmy Greaves story. I just wanted something that would just capture everything about him. And I think that one word, as we've been talking about all evening, is kind of what does it, you know, natural to me, you know, the Jimmy Greaves story, that is it. As far as I'm concerned,
it is, and congratulations, and it's a great way to plug right at the end, because, like I say, as a human story, it's fantastic. As a story about a footballer, it's fantastic. But those who will have lived through his playing career, it will bring back great memories. For those who didn't, who were too young to remember him as a footballer, it's a great story of an incredibly, and again using that word, naturally talented footballer. We are going to offer a copy of David's book as a prize. That will be on through the These Football Times Twitter site once this podcast is released. So there will be an opportunity to win one. But obviously, people can only win one, and there will be more than one person wanting to buy this book. David, thank you so much for being a guest, and also thank you for writing such a wonderful book.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
No problem at all. Gary, as always, wonderful. I'm sure it was a very enjoyable trip down memory lane for yourself.
Definitely. And so anybody who's old enough to, like me, to remember Jimmy Greaves playing, go out and buy David's book, because it's full of memories and explains the things that we sort of might have half forgotten and brings it back to light again. It brought so many memories back. But if you don't remember Jimmy Greaves, if you're not old enough to remember it, this is a guy who was a natural goal scorer. Go out and buy the book and understand more about Jimmy Greaves.
Absolutely. Absolutely echo that. And Stephen, as always, once again, thank you very much for your contributions.
A brilliant way to spend an evening again. fantastic topic, fantastic book, great guest.
Brilliant. So all that's left for me to say is to thank the listeners, and please join us again next time on the Lob podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.